From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Linda Feldman for the Christian Science Monitor and Steve Goldstein for MarketWatch. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A horrific attack on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, left dozens dead and wounded. And once again, the world mourns and asks why. The crash of a second Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft in just 5 months has led to the grounding of the fleet around the world and has shaken confidence in the safety of air travel. The U.S. Senate took two significant votes that run counter to the wishes of the Trump White House, a rare show of congressional independence that opens the way for President Trump to use his veto powers for the first time. Former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was sentenced in a second federal court for crimes including conspiracy against the U.S. and lying to federal investigators, while the U.S. House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to make public the upcoming report from Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. And former Texas congressman and rising political star Beto O'Rourke became the latest entry into an already crowded field of Democratic candidates for the presidency in 2020. So much to talk about today. First, we want to start off with this horrific crime that took place in New Zealand. What we know at this time is that at least 49 dead, some 20 or more injured. So I'll start with you, Linda. What do we know at this point?
We know that there are multiple suspects.
Yes.
Three men, one woman, at least one suspect is appearing in court. Mm-hmm. It is a nation in shock. New Zealand does not have a history of gun violence. It doesn't even have a history of murder.
Of murder at all.
The statistics, sometimes in the single digits, the number of murders a year in New Zealand. And as everybody has been saying, they don't have a problem with Muslim radicalization. They just don't have any of the problems that we're seeing in bigger countries. Mm. With hate crimes.
The one thing that we are learning, the actual murderer who had not only sort of admitted it, but was filming himself carrying out the atrocity, comes from Australia and has been posting on these very extremist websites. And there does seem to be a linkage between what happened here and what also happened in the U.S. in Pittsburgh and what happened in Canada and Quebec. And I think kind of saw it described as a white nationalist ISIS. So in other words, and really using many of the same memes.
Is this movement centered in New Zealand? Do we think that at this time?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think this is a global movement of extremists who seem to be radicalized by what happened in Norway, actually, a few years ago. That was referenced. Almost like ISIS, you have to do the same thing in reverse. You have to look at how they're being radicalized, and you have to be ready to take action when they indicate that it's more than just talk, but actual, you know, something is on the move. And that's something I think that global security has been lacking, that they are, you know, that they have treated sort of the jihadist threat, for lack of a better word, seriously, but they have not treated this. And I think it's showing it deserves the same attention, and you have to attack it with the same sort of methods.
Linda, the authorities in New Zealand have closed down churches, schools, mm-hmm. mosques. They're asking people not to go to their places of worship. Right. Is the situation still the same now as far as you know? And has the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has she declared that there's any margin for safety now? Is it over?
We don't know. I mean, there appears to be some kind of conspiracy with multiple people suspected. And as we know, the copycat mindset is, I think, the big fear right now. And even a peaceful country like New Zealand, I mean, there are no boundaries in
for hatred.
For hatred and for social media. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that he live streamed this on Facebook it's beyond imaginable. So I think we almost need a sort of a global day of prayer, just to sit back and think about reflectively how we as a global community can address this kind of problem.
Yeah, from one human being to do that particular thing to a number of other human beings, it strains the limits of my heart and my brain mm-hmm. to figure out how individuals get into that position. And we, of course, send our very best and warmest wishes to those who are suffering through this very difficult time in New Zealand. Let's move on to the Senate, U.S. Senate. There were two significant votes this week. One was to block the national emergency declaration of President Trump at the southern border of the U.S. That was a 61-49 vote. And there was another vote that was 54-46 to end U.S. aid to Yemen in their war that is supported by Saudi Arabia. Let's start with the vote to reject the president's declaration of an emergency at the southern border. Steve, it's significant that we had a relatively large number of Republicans coming out and joining Democrats to vote for this thing. Who were they and how significant is that number?
Well, the significance of the Republicans who supported it is that they mostly were not people who are up for election in 2020. In fact, the only one who voted for the resolution is Susan Collins, a moderate from Maine. If you look at the other Republicans who voted, people like Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, well-known opponents to President Trump in many regards, but also people who are not facing the voters' wrath soon. And it's interesting that I think the most interesting situation was in North Carolina, where you had Senator Tillis, who had declared in an opinion piece mm-hmm. that he was against what Trump was doing and ended up voting in support of it. And the rumors were that he was going to face a primary challenge if he had not done what he had done. So it was interesting. You really got to see the Republican divide pretty clearly.
So no real surprises, really, as far as how that vote broke down, I would think.
There was, Senator Wicker from Mississippi opposed Trump's plan. That was, to me, little bit of a surprise. But again, mostly these are the sort of the Republicans we expected.
A little before I ask you a question, I'll just get your thoughts. And then.
Well, I think, this is an important week in terms of the Republicans in the Senate finally rising up to oppose something the president was doing. This will be his first veto of legislation after more than 2 years in office. But I think for many of them, the way to justify it was to say this is about the constitutional powers of the Congress. This is not about opposing border security. This is about the president, many think, overreaching in his ability to use federal monies in ways that Congress has not approved. And so for somebody, say for Senator Mike Lee, the other senator from Utah, along with Mitt Romney, who is a big constitutionalist, conservative in that sense, this is why he would vote to oppose the president's declaration of a national emergency.
And Ben Sasse was another that sort of surprised me because he's a young senator from Nebraska, I believe.
Yes.
Nebraska. And he is very, air quotes, principled type of Republican who talked very often about the powers of the presidency and wanting and the powers of the legislative branch and wanting to preserve those things. And sure enough, he votes to uphold the president's position. I think that what a lot of people had a problem with was being lectured to at some point by guys like Tom Tillis and then having him go the other way. So there's the politics of it. There's the policy of it. See, at the end of the day, the president is going to veto this. Where does that leave us in terms of the policy then?
So part in the recent budget agreement, he got funding for slightly over $1 billion to expand the current barrier on the U.S.-Mexican border. And then he's wants about $8 billion in total. And he draws some of that from this emergency declaration. He's also repurposing money allocated to the Treasury Department to fight against drug offenses. Immediately, there are court challenges, I believe some 17 states. So I do expect that to be tied up in court for a while. So I guess they will proceed with the building of what Congress has appropriated while the courts sort of decide on the rest of it.
Right. And before we go to break, we've got a minute or two, Linda. We had another vote with Yemen, with the Senate voting by a slimmer margin, admittedly, and fewer Republicans joining with the Democrats to vote this way, a 54-46 vote to aid to Yemen. Talk a little bit about the policy to that. And I want to pose you the question also. We're having these votes. Mm-hmm. Does that mean, do I actually see movement in government? Is government working a little bit again?
Well, you've got the legislative branch finally rising up and expressing some opposition to what the Trump administration is doing, including members of his own party. The legislation on Yemen was aimed at curtailing the U.S. role in Yemen's civil war.
Right.
And what this really was a slap at President Trump for his close relationship with Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and of course an expression of discontent over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which the White House still hasn't really addressed. So this is a little bit of, you know, people rearing their head, but as we've made clear, all the senators who are up for re-election next time, with one exception, Susan Collins of Maine, have backed down and have towed the party line. So I'd say it's a baby step, but at least it's something.
Yeah, I think that this vote with Yemen, it expresses the displeasure with the Trump administration's particular disregard for our sensitivity to what happened to Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes.
There's always been a rather dubious relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, so this sort of puts that in a different light. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. You can also visit us on Facebook. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Linda Feldman for the Christian Science Monitor and Steve Goldstein for Market Watch. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. The crash of a Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft in Ethiopia, tragically killing all 157 aboard. And just 5 months after another air crash in Indonesia, has led to the grounding of that fleet, the 737, I believe MAX 8 and MAX 9, I believe it is. As it stands right now, the U.S. was among the last to finally ground the fleet. Where do we stand in this in terms of knowing what the cause of the crashes were and what was the cause of the grounding of the fleet?
Well, we know with this particular airplane, that it has a propensity during takeoff to have issues that could lead to the plane nosediving. This is something Boeing's known all along, but what they did in this airplane is they designed what they thought were safeguards so that pilots could take action to prevent it from, once that sort of situation arose, to then, you know, course correct. But we've seen now with two instances where that didn't happen. Boeing was aware of this issue, and in fact, they have been working for some time on some sort of software upgrade to the plane. I couldn't tell you the specifics of what that upgrade would do. But until that is, you know, carried out on all the airplanes, all of them basically around the world are now grounded. And that's very significant. You do have some major U.S. carriers, including American and Southwest, that do rely on this particular plane in some sort of size. I think with Southwest, it accounts for about 5% of their fleet. So having that percentage of your fleet grounded is very significant. I think that's one of the business reasons why the FAA was not as prompt as some of these other foreign aviation authorities to take action. It's a very serious development, really, for Boeing, which is a crown jewel of the U.S. defense and obviously aviation establishment.
Let's talk about that a little bit because we had the U.S. being among the last to ground the fleet. We have a former Boeing executive as the acting Secretary of Defense right now. We have obviously a close relationship between any administration, I would say, and Boeing aircraft being such a significant player in aviation and industry in the United States. The fact that this grounding took so long to happen, does that point to maybe a little bit too cozy of a relationship? Did that put people at risk, the relationship between Boeing and the government?
So a lot of people are asking that question. I think it's too soon to say. You have to be careful not to immediately blame the Trump administration for this. And you've also seen people blaming the government shutdown over the delays and getting the software fixes after the Lion Air crash.
Right.
So I don't want to sort of overstate the possibilities here. A lot, you know, you've seen an outcry from the left and among some presidential candidates talking about the power of lobbyists and how that might have contributed to the delay in the American government's decision to ground those planes. But it's for sure those are questions worth asking.
Absolutely. And there's some question to be asked about why Boeing wouldn't have voluntarily grounded their own aircraft, seeing that there may have been what looks like a problem that they knew about. As you say, there is some indication at this point that they had known about a problem, that there was some work being done about a problem, but this problem had not become public. It hadn't become common knowledge, and certainly it hadn't been fixed. So given the fact that we have Boeing out working on this, we have a fleet of aircraft that's on the ground, and I don't want to be too craven about this because the loss of life is, in fact, the number one issue here. But what kind of exposure is Boeing facing at this point?
That's a good question. You know, in the stock market, their stock has had a very difficult week, as you would imagine.
As you would imagine.
One of the concerns, really, is this is for future sales. This will have a big impact, not just on airlines deciding which plane, but also the price. You know, there's very airlines and Boeing and Airbus, the other manufacturer, have very intensive discussions also over price. So from a stock market perspective, that's why you saw this big drop. There aren't many other places to turn to. So Airbus is their big rival, but you can't just scale up at a capacity to produce this sort of level
of plane. Let's produce several hundred aircraft.
That's just not going to happen. So, you know, these airlines are going to continue to take Boeing planes. In fact, this particular model, they'll continue to take it. But we don't know at what price. There are obviously could be delays. And it's a significant reputation impact as well. You really have to question Boeing's management at this point. But it certainly doesn't look good. And also, you know, we're talking here about the civil side of things, but again, they're a major defense player, and that's where there is competition in the defense world. So I think that's another reason why the business prospects for Boeing are definitely hurt by what's happened here.
Linda?
You also have to wonder, to me, I mean, I've been reading about how the training for this new system, this new so-called safety system, was not substantial at all. And I don't understand why Boeing couldn't recognize that quickly and immediately ramp up the training of the pilots. And that's where the regulators get in. And I have to point out that the Federal Aviation Administration is the head of that agency in the U.S. is an acting administrator. We have a lot of acting, so-called acting, not permanent,
as opposed to confirmed.
As opposed to confirmed by the Senate. Yep. This is a record number of acting very top-level positions, including Secretary of Defense. I'm not saying that any of this is to blame, but it just, to me, speaks of a sort of an erosion of the effectiveness of government that we're seeing right now. And one hopes that the Trump administration can address this and find people, top-notch people, to take these jobs.
I'm not a lawyer myself, but I know a few, and the word that I've gotten is that what Boeing faces is the fact that in many of these lawsuits where they've had liability when crashes have happened in other countries, what they have successfully lobbied to do is to have the laws of that country pervade so that it limited liability. We have 8 U.S. citizens that died on the last aircraft. Right. So the chances that these things are litigated in U.S. civil courts is raised significantly by that fact. So we'll keep an eye on the situation, and I'm sure report back here. Paul Manafort receives a second sentence in federal court. Seems to be a weekly occurrence with Paul Manafort now. It's interesting to me when we look at the charges: conspiracy, perjury, money laundering for a man who was 2 years ago the head of the Trump campaign. It's just incredible, the charges that are attached to him. Has received now a total of 7.5 years between the two sentencing. I'll start with you, Linda, on this one with the two sentencings there. What was he sentenced for by the two judges, and what differences did you see between those two hearings and the two results? They were very different.
Well, to me, this was the classic. So everybody says, oh, there's no such thing as Obama judges or, you know, Trump judges, Reagan judges, what have you. But we saw here a classic example of that, where you had the judge in the first sentencing, Judge Ellis in Virginia. This was over serious financial misdeeds by Paul Manafort. This has nothing to do, actually, with the whole Trump-Russia situation. This is Paul Manafort his dealings in Ukraine and Russia and making millions and millions of dollars and not reporting it on his taxes. I mean, he cheated taxes to the point of, what is $50 million,
right.
some ridiculous sum of money. And people would have expected perhaps to take a maximal approach to sentencing, but he only got less than four years from Judge Ellis.
And time served.
And time served. He's already been behind bars for 9 months, I think. So there was that case, Judge Ellis, Reagan appointee, and then bring that into the District of Columbia with an Obama judge, Amy Jackson Berman, who perhaps felt the need to kind of make up for the seemingly lenient sentence from Judge Ellis and tacked on
an additional
4 years for crimes that are, yes, serious, but not as substantial in my book. Maybe it all evens out. Paul Manafort is unwell. He's 69 years old. They're saying he'll probably be able to leave prison in 6 years, but who knows if he makes it that long.
So, Steve, we have a couple of things. We have him being sentenced. We have charges being filed immediately at the state level in New York. So he's not done in court by a long shot. And you have a president who is or is not dangling a pardon, certainly to an attorney who, with his statements to the public after the two trials, is clearly angling for a pardon. I've given you a lot to digest there, so you go ahead and arrange those blocks however you like.
Well, I think this is the big question. Will President Trump pardon Paul Manafort? Trump has said on many occasions words to the effect that he feels sorry for him, some sort of sympathizing expression toward Manafort.
Because he didn't flip. And that's sort of the buried lead. He never was cooperative, which was part of his sentencing.
But we also don't know what he had to flip either, which is President Trump's claim all along that there was no collusion. You know, it's impossible for us to know what he knew that could be of use or not. So we don't know if he had something good to flip or not. We definitely know that he did not. And we know that he lied.
He
absolutely lied. Yes. And he cheated on his taxes and all the rest. Trump views him, Paul Manafort, as being in his camp. He'll have to decide whether he pardons or not. There's already a huge congressional pushback to this, but that doesn't mean that the president won't go through with it. And there's also the timing of it. But now the fact that the sentencing is done means the window is now open for Trump to consider a pardon. He would not have done it prior to the sentencing. Manafort already has pleaded guilty, so that's another obstacle that's sort of out of the way. Anyone who receives a pardon has to admit to their crimes. That's not a problem with Manafort. So it's definitely a possibility, and I think it would raise a firestorm if he did it, which is why maybe it would be something that Trump will do after the election and not before.
We have just 1 minute or so left, and I do want to talk about Beto O'Rourke. Mm. His main accomplishment and the credential right now is losing an election to Ted Cruz in Texas for the Senate, but he's generated tremendous enthusiasm in the press and in Democratic political circles by announcing that he is running for president. And although each of you for 30 seconds on this, I just say, when you look at Joe Biden, who's probably going to announce, Bernie Sanders and Beto, is that three serious contenders? Or is it 2.5 men?
I have to think it's 2.5 men. There's no perfect candidate out there, but the Beto O'Rourke candidacy, to me, this is a direct result of Donald Trump. Somebody with a thin resume for government, but has performance capabilities.
Well said.
Who can get cable TV to run your events live. You've got Beto O'Rourke standing on a table, waving his arms. I mean, he's a very compelling character, but I think once the excitement wears off, what's left? I don't know. I see this flaming out.
Steve, last word.
So I'm not sure he's going to flame out. And actually, the president he reminds me more of is actually Barack Obama. Certainly different biographies, but you still have that charisma and really his approach to things and very much his attempt to be a unifier, whether he is or not, does remind me of Obama. And just one last point, we did have a president who previously lost a Senate election before winning, and his name was Abraham Lincoln.
I knew you were going to say that, Steve. Well out. That is, in fact, all the time we have for this week. My thanks to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch. This program is produced by Patrice Martin. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.